Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about...
This is episode 4 of Chasing the Sun by Richard Cohen, the epic story of the star that gives us life. This is chapter 2, first 3 episodes as the preface, sort of an odd non-chapter, zeroth chapter, slitted in for part 1, and chapter 1. This is chapter 2, called Celebrating the Seasons, which is slightly different from... the previous chapter, which was entitled, what was it? Telling Stories. It's about the mythology of the sun. And it sort of made some points that the mythology of the sun was creating a sort of anthropomorphization, that is, casting a character and a reason for it. And that reason would be told as part of the mythology of things. And part of the overarching idea was that the sun would come down and be a god and have children with the ruling class. This is a mythology which was born out. So there's a large number of cultures who believed that their right to rule was from the divinity of having the sun worship with them. And I'm so sort of surprised that they, in this... I refer to the Sun King, which is Louis, who had the picture of the sun as an evident legend. I'm really surprised that that's not actually covered by some other angle here. The next section, chapter, is very similar. So going back to that first chapter, he looks at a few mythologies, then starts to do the... historiography of mythology, that is, who studied mythologies and the various people. The initial person who had the sweeping, all-encompassing, everything is to do with the Aryan race and sun myths, and then little by little people had slightly different things, but perhaps equally sweeping, that the majority of cultures have a sun myth built into their hierarchy. So this is particularly true with the Japanese, though that wasn't pointed there. There's a lot of things, and then the sun soap opera stories about the Chinese shooting down additional suns. The sun's been bad. The sun's having a love affair with the moon, and various things like that. Also touching on the complexity of the sun myths, the Egypt having three layers of sun myths, and other cultures, like the Mayan cultures, have the sun rebirths, but in a different guise. So the sun goes away, rebirths as a fire sun, a pestilence sun, an earthquake sun, all these sorts of things coming up. And now, Celebrating the Seasons, chapter 2, just to finish that, so after looking at the historiography of it, he himself decides to go to a modern-day celebration. And I just can't quite remember. It's basically it's the story of the sun and sun gods and the Inca. Inca is another group involved in it. He goes along to something which is obviously extremely touristy in 2004. In Peru, and at the end of it, the sun bursts through the sky, and so he sort of wraps it up in that direction. So it's just trying to delineate the differences between the two different chapters. So this is mythology where there's a lot of story. The sun does things, the sun behaves in a particular way, and in particular, the sun behaves in a way which gives various the Inca and various the Japanese, various authority, although he didn't cover the Japanese. Now, this is Celebrating the Seasons, so this, I've had a little read through this, a little bit intractable, in that this is slightly different. This is celebrations of a particular time of year. Rather than celebrating the sun, you're celebrating a particular season and the event. And in here, I'll break off and give a bit of physics about what's going on. But as we say, this is chapter 2, and the first quote here is from John Donne, and a nocturnal upon St. Lucy's Day being the shortest day of the year. So the shortest day is Solstice Day. So the sun gets, the days get shorter and shorter and shorter, and eventually the difference between days goes to a minimum. It stops and then extends, so it's like going from, its rate slows down. So Solstice is the shortest day of the year, but it's also the date at which the sun climbs no higher in its zenith through the sky. So it's Lucy's Day. Now let's see what he says this time, John Donne. "'Tis the year midnight, tis the year's midnight, and on it is the day's St. Lucy's, who scarce 7 hours herself unmasks. The sun has spent, and now he flasks, sent forth like squibs, no constant rays, the world's whole sap is sunk." Okay, it is essentially the shortest, the darkest time of the season, so it's effectively the midnight of year, and the day is rather than 12 or more than 12 hours, it's less than 12 hours long, it's only 7 hours long, and the remainder, what would it be, 5 plus 12, 17 hours? 17 hours would be dark. Like squibs, I love the word squibs, I must admit, it's not in common uses with me, I don't quite know what it is. This next quote is by Alan First, Dark Star, so I don't know what Dark Star means. "The summer solstice, the day the sun is said to pause," he thought, pleasing that idea, as though the universe stopped for a moment to reflect, "took a day off from work, one could sense it, time slowing down." So I suppose the interesting thing about solstice is the shortest day precedes winter, so the day starts lengthening up, but it takes a while for it to chill down. And similarly with summer goes after the summer solstice, and so summer, I think, begins in December, which summer's 3 months too long, and so ideally your solstice will be in the middle of January, but it's a few weeks, 2 weeks earlier. It was 4 weeks in a month, roughly. Now let's read this at some point, and I'll try and break and actually give some solar physics. At one point in Huckleberry Finn flight downriver, so this is Huckleberry Finn runs away and goes down the Mississippi River, I think with a slave, I think. He comes across a copy of Pilgrim's Progress, a book about a man that has left his family. He didn't say why. So that's Mark Twain's explanation, Huckleberry's word. There's Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn, I get the two mixed up, which he leafs through and decides, quote, "The statement was interesting but tough." That is, the world of solar physics for many people looking into it has got really interesting stories, but it's hard to stick it together. "Studying the sun may provoke the same reaction, for there is no easy way to explain how it works." Well, especially if you've got no idea of science. "We may think of it as rising daily in the east and setting in the west, but it does so at different times for different durations in different places. As Barry Lopez observes in his great book on the Arctic, in the far northern winter, the sun surfaces slowly in the south and then disappears in nearly the same spot, like a whale rolling over." So this is the winter, when the Earth has just got most of the waste of the Earth covering the sun, the day is very short. So you'll see the sun just pop above the horizon and sink, whereas other parts of the year it will actually never quite dip underneath the horizon. So rather than in midwinter, it may only, say, cover 10 degrees of range, but in mid-summer, where there's almost endless day, it may go 350 degrees before it dips underneath the horizon. If you're above the Arctic Circle, there'll be one day in which it doesn't actually move move across. Now, this is so too for you in your seasons. In summer, it's got the greatest, say, if you're in the northern hemisphere, in summer, it's a bit south of west, comes out, and is that right? I was trying to work this out. In summer, it will be a bit north of west, and it rises a bit north of east, lands a bit north of west. In the solstice, it lands precisely east and west, and in the that's the equinox. But in the solstice, the winter solstice, it lands more south of east and west, a smaller arc throughout the sky, lower zenith. And so it's the highest point in summer, or the lowest point in the sky, and shortest arc in winter. And this is, you all get this by this classic tilt of the Earth's axis, and the Earth's axis maintains the same direction as space as it goes around due to the conservation of angular momentum. But there are other features. The Earth has a elliptical orbit going from at its closest approach to just under 150 million to the furthest approach, the furthest distance is 152 million. 152 million kilometres out in terms of the rotation. There's sort of different ways of seeing it. So the length of a day is always 23 hours and 56 minutes to rotate in space. However, what happens is that as you rotate, you're also orbiting, so you orbit a bit further, and you need an extra 4 minutes of rotation to get back to the same point looking at the sun. Now, this varies a bit more because the rate at which you are orbiting changes. If you are far out from the sun, you're further away from the sun, you're traveling more slowly, so the length of the day is actually shorter the further you're out, because it's closer to 53 minutes, 53 hours and 56 minutes, because the Earth is moving less in space around the sun, whereas when you're closest approach, it appears the Earth is taking a bit longer to move around. So, as far as the Earth is concerned, the Sun moves across the sky at different speeds. So, in the European summer, the Sun is moving more slowly, i.e., the Earth is moving more slowly. In the Australian summer, the sun is closer but moving more quickly across the sky. Just a bit to take in, but you have to sort of factor in the elliptical orbit. Okay, reading this, this is over the day. This is the Arctic. This is of a morning, forenoon, afternoon, and evening is a convention. It's thought that the day consists of these components. One so embedded in us that we hardly think about it. The sun is not a simple star, particularly in regard to the seasons. During the course of the year, the hours of sunlight vary from a maximum day known as summer solstice, which augurs the beginning of summer, to a minimum solstice, which signals the beginning of winter. So it's not in the middle, it's at the beginning of it. Or not really, it's for us, it's in December 26, and the 1st of December is our summer. In summer, the sun is brighter and reaches higher into the sky, shortening the shadows that it casts. In winter, it rises and sinks closer to the horizon. The light diffuses and the shadows lengthen. Okay, so the sun directly is bright. So if the sun is directly ahead, the sun's rays can reach us. So the sun's rays bend and deflect a little bit due to a process called Mie scattering, M-E-I scattering. And this is sort of when you look at the sun at sunset, when you look at the sun, it's up above you, it seems very big. It's got this big white halo around it, and that's due to scattering in the sky. This is small angle scattering. Let's see if I can explain it. As a hemisphere, the horizon, as a hemisphere tilts steadily further away from the sun, daylight becomes shorter, and the sun makes ever lower arcs through the sky. That's a beautiful way of describing it. On the first day of winter, the time is the briefest. The sun rises at a point nearest to the equator. Okay, for you, that's in the northern hemisphere, nearest to the equator, south, more southerly. On the year's longest day, it rises closest to the hemisphere's poles. I may have got that back to front in explaining it. Before it begins doubling back. The turning of the sun, an ancient idiom used by the Hesiod and Homer, that is, the sun starts moving up, getting across. I don't know whether I've described it the best there. We see the effects of dawn when, for 2 or 3 days, the sun seems to linger for several minutes, hence the word solstice. So the effect of dawn, the sun appears to linger for several minutes. For the soul, sun, and sitim, sistiera, to stand still, armistice, translates as weapon standstill. Okay, I'm just trying to work this out. So they're saying that the sun actually appears to be still at dawn. Well, that's a pretty amazing event. Why would that be? I was trying to really think why that phenomenon would be. It's why would the sun appears to be still at dawn, the sun explained. In the northern hemisphere, the first days of spring, autumn, fall between the 19th and 21st of March. And the 19th, the northern hemisphere, the first day of spring falls between the 19th and 21st of March, and the end of autumn, the 19th and 21st of September. So this is equinox, when you have equally long days and nights. This is 12-hour days, 12-hour nights, as it's crossing from the shortest to the longest point. Now, of course, this is not precisely, it's not, you can't have it precisely as a circle driven forward because it's an ellipse. And so this process is day and night is slightly different. It's not exactly the same length to it. Now, as the summer begins with the solstice, the spring and summer and winter begins with the solstice, the spring and autumn begins with an equinox. These are equinoxes from aequinox, meaning equal night, when the hours of dark and the night are roughly even all over the planet. The sun appears directly overhead at midday, after which it will keep advancing northwards after the 21st of March and southward over the 21st of September. I think this is a rather complex thing because obviously the sun will never appear directly overhead. So just working through what he means there. If you're on the equator and the Earth has spinning such that the axis, I suppose, tilts but makes a 90-degree angle with the line between the centre of the Earth and the centre of the sun, and it's rotating that way, the sun will appear directly overhead at midday. At the equinox and at the solstice, summer solstice, it's tropic for which that orbit occurs, it will be directly overhead then. The rest of the year, it's there. So there'll be 2 days a year inside the tropics where the sun is directly across over the top of your head. one day a year if you're on the actual tropic, and no days a year if you're beneath the tropic, to try and get this across. And the further north and further south is depends about the length of time between directly overhead. It's just trying to get that into your head. So this person hasn't really explained it really well. Many astronomers, as well as mariners, believe the equinox brought strong gales, a myth, or at least a misconception, possibly because of the sharp rise in the number of high winds the second half of September. And then when the hurricane season does indeed reach its height in the northern hemisphere, but for reasons differently related to the sun. They are not alone. Herodotus, recording a summer flooding of the Nile, speaks of the Egyptian sun driven from its old course by storms during winter, then returning to the middle of the sky in spring. So their idea is that the sun, rather than causing the weather moves the sun. Societies were organized around agricultures that were organized around agriculture, such as those in the early Egypt and the Americas, intently studied the heavens carefully, noting what happened each year and ensuring that the solstices and the equinoxes were well charted. Despite their best efforts, however, their priests and stargazers come to realize that it was exceptionally hard to pinpoint the moment of solstice by observation alone, even though they could define successive seasons by the advancing and the withdrawal of daylight and daylight, albeit by another twitch of nature, and the earliest and latest sunrises of sunsets do not fall on solstices. So this, I suppose, which I find a bit aggravating here, because the person hasn't factored in the elliptical orbit, and the elliptical orbit then means that your solstices aren't in because of your angles with respect. So the angles of your solstice is different from the midpoints going across for your longest and shortest days. So this is the, albeit by a twitch of nature, the earliest and latest sunrises and sunsets do not fall at the solstices. However, so what will happen is that your sunset will be the latest, and at a different time your sunset will be at the latest at a different time. Your sunrise will be at the earliest. This gets to the longest day of the year. And so it's just in between those two events that you get your solstice, because it's one moves and the other moves at a slightly different rate due to the eccentricity of the orbit. The Earth further complicates matters. Our globe is tilts on the axis like a spinning top, orbiting the Sun at 23 degrees and 27 minutes. And this determines how much light any part of the planet receives at any given time. Not only does the spin, its shape minutely alters as the axis wobbles, a process called nutation nodding. So the Earth's orbit fluctuates between greater circularity and greater elongation. This is bizarre. If the globe's axis didn't wobble, and if its orbits were a true circle, the equinoxes and solstices would be quarter of a year into equal parts. But our orbit being elliptical, the time between spring and autumn equinoxes in the northern hemisphere is slightly greater than the autumn and spring, the Earth moving about 6% faster in January than in July. Okay, so that's another step of doing it. The nutation and the change of orbits from circular to elongated is a complex thing. So just to give you an idea, The important thing to point about this is that the moon stabilizes the Earth. So I've just got to get all my scientific theory out there. The moon has kept the Earth pretty much on 23 degrees, but if you've got a planet like Mars, Mars can swing its axis. It can the angular momentum has to be conserved, so if you want to, you can have the axis turn a greater direction and the orbit be more circular, or the axis can straighten up and the axis axis be more egg-shaped. So there's a bit of maths involved in that. So the Earth is not equal to that, because we've got a huge amount of angular momentum in our system, because we've got the moon in there stabilizing it. But as said, the equinox and solstices are a little bit more complex because we've got an elliptical orbit, and he's actually told us 6%. Okay, but he hasn't really explained this in a way that I can sort of pull apart. I suppose I could explain it better if I had a bit more time, but particularly a diagram would help. I think this is an area where you actually do need a diagram. But it's interesting, at least he's trying to explain it in text. If the globe's axis didn't wobble, and if its orbit were a true circle, the equinox and solstice would be quarter of a year apart in equal parts. The Earth moving... the Sun takes 94 days to go from the vernal equinox to the summer solstice, 92 days to go from the autumnal equinox, and 89 days from there to the winter solstice, and 90 days back again to the vernal equinox. So the actual differences are not. They're hovering above and below 90 days as you go across. Again, I'm just not in the mood to actually speak through this. But the equinox and solstices aren't there. Another way of doing it is seeing the Sun trace a figure 8 in the sky. I wonder if he actually does that. So if you've got a sundial, you have to correct for various minutes doing that, the correction you will note is the Sun's shadow at midday will trace out a figure 8, and you've got to use that figure 8 is drawn in the sky. I've got to think of the word for that figure 8 in the sky. It's a particular word, so this person hasn't really described it. So you know, I would have had a diagram and the figure 8 to explain it. So yeah, if I photographed the Sun at precisely a rotation of the Earth midday, right? So the Earth is actually pointing at the same point, I suppose, less four minutes, exactly 24 minutes, 24 hours apart, and I photograph the Sun, and I take a photograph day after day, the Sun will go up and down the horizon, but also go travel a bit more to the west and a bit more to the east as it goes around, and that will, as it's going back, will trace a figure 8. And it's the top and the bottom of the figure 8 is the solstices, but the equinox is another point there. It takes a bit to go. Okay. Now let's listen to hear what this have to say. At high latitudes, the amount of solar energy received at midsummer can vary by 20% depending on whether the Earth's various wobbles reinforce each other or cancel each other out. Tough but interesting. I just find that hard to comprehend what he means there. Because the wobble year on year is exactly the same. The apparent supernatural power manifests in solstice and equinox has been felt as far back as we know, indicating different reactions in different cultures, fertility rites, fire festivals, offering to the gods. Many of the wintertime customs of Western Europe descended from the ancient Romans who believed their harvest deity, Saturn, had ruled the land during an earlier age of rich crops, and so celebrated the winter solstice with its promise of return to summer, with a Saturnalia, a high feast of gift-giving, role reversal, slaves beating their masters, and general public holiday each year from the 17th to the 24th of December, which is the solstice. They mark planting and harvesting with the ritual that entailed a winning horse from the great chariot race being sacrificed to the sun. It's a horrible thing to think. You win your race and you get put down. It would be no Melbourne Cup winner. Goodbye, Farlap. A temple stood on the Avatar, on the city's original seven hills, and the populace would watch the races, looking up to see the sun's image glowing from the roof. It being blasphemous to make a spectacle of this greatness indoors. The historian Macrobius explained the celebrations. Said, a horse race indoors? I quite get my head around it. Here's a quote from Macrobius. Certainly it is not empty superstition, but divine reason that makes them relate almost all of the gods, at any rate the celestial gods, to the sun. For it is the sun, as the old believed, quote, guards and directs the rest of the heavenly lights, and alone presides over the planets in other courses, and if the movements of the planets themselves have power, as some think, to foretell the sequence of human destinies, we have to admit the sun, as directing the powers that direct our affairs, is the author of all that goes on around us. So he's a ancient historian. I don't know what he's on about, but he's working things out for himself. Dangerous thing, you'll get killed. The transition from the Roman Empire and its pagan rituals to Christianity, with its similar rites, took place over several centuries. These were the years of great upheaval between 235 and 284. I think that was just a revolving door for the emperors. So let's see. 26 different usurpers seized power in Rome, culminating in Constantine's great triumph at the Milavian Bridge in AD 312. So this is a good 30 years after the end of this upheaval period, which reunited the empire and ended half a century of civil war. Ascribing his victory to the Christian god, Constantine was later baptized in the new religion and enacted laws to advance Christianity. Now, what's interesting here is that his vision was of the sun. The crucifix was on the sun. Just really amazing use of things. So, he looked at the sun and had an optical illusion of the crucifix. So, this should be in here, but it's not. Many other customs were now appropriated and refashioned. As the sun and the sun, God's sun, became inextricably entwined in people's mind. Thus, although the New Testament gives no indication of Christ's actual birthday, earlier writers preferring a spring date, in 354, Liberus, Bishop of Rome, declared it to have occurred on the 25th of December. The advantages of being Christmas Day being celebrated when there was an obvious, as the Christian commentator Cyrus wrote. Now, you would have heard me progressively get a bit more tired, and that's indeed what's happened. This is the next day out here in beautiful Australia where I'm reading on from this. So as I get a bit tired, my sort of speech slows down, things like that. I went off and studied a few interesting things just to get my bearings on where this guy's coming from, and I'll do an episode on that a bit later on. This is a quote from the commentator Cyrus. It was a custom of the pagans to celebrate on the same 25th of December the birthday of the sun, at which they kindled lights in token of festivities. In these solemnities and revelries, the Christians took part. Accordingly, when the church authorities perceived that Christians had a leaning to this festival, they took counsel and resolved that the true nativity should be solemnized on that day. Okay, so they have reasons to believe that this has nothing to do with Christ's birthday. It is the festival of the sun. In Christendom, the Nativity gradually absorbed all the other winter solstice rites, and the co-opting of the solar imagery was part of the same process. I don't think so. It's the same generalized process. Thus, the solar disks that had once been depicted behind the heads of Asian rulers became the halos of Christian luminaries. When the question arose on which day of the week should be given up to celebrating Mass, the Church's father, Justin Martyr, would shrewdly explain to Emperor Marcus Aurelius that Christians chose the day they did for celebrating the Eucharist because it's on what is called the Sun's Day, and that all who abide in the town or the country come together. And we meet on the sun's day because it is the first day on which God formed the darkness and mere matter into the world. So that's why it was Sunday. Sort of Christian thing, but it was an existing pagan spot. Now for... sorry, I've got this bit of a lurgy in my throat. A luminary's got an asterisk to it. Christian art first avoided the halo because of its pagan origins, but from about the mid-4th century, Christ was portrayed wearing a crown of sun rays, as in effigies of the Roman Emperor. Then, from about the 6th century on, the Virgin Mary and other saints were depicted with halos, and by the 9th, the symbol had been completely assimilated. Again, some Christians were reluctant to use the pagan word Sunday. In the Latin-speaking Christian countries, and most Romance languages, the first day of the week became forever Lord's Day. Dominica, Dimanche, Domingo, Domenica. Isn't that incredible? So that's why Dimanche. I didn't know that. During Constantine's reign, the first day of the week was regarded by both pagans and Christians as a high point. And in 321, he officially proclaimed Sunday as a holy day of the week. Sometimes Christians believe it was for their sake and began calling it Sunday rather than Lord's Day. Okay. It is on what is called Sun's Day that all who abide in the town and country come together. And we meet on the Sun's Day because it's the first day in which God formed darkness and mere matter into the world. So that's a sort of like you can often tell explanations which are made ahead or after an event because they are so well structured and they come from different angles and they're well polished, whereas explanations ahead of an event are usually not the best ones. For a long time, the fixing of festivals remained something of a hit or miss affair. Over the winter solstice, the Romans were unsure which was the shortest day of the year. Julius Caesar officially marked it as the 25th. Pliny, in the first Christian century, put it on the 26th of December, while his contemporary Calamaria chose the 23rd. By 567, the Council of Tours declared that the whole period from Christmas to the Feast of Epiphany on the 6th of January should form one cycle, and by the 8th century, a system of 12 days of celebration was in place, with the Epiphany, day 13, starting a new sequence. Thus was created, in the words of Roland Hutton, quote, a period between winter solstice and the traditional Roman time of New Year, in which politics, education, commerce were alike suspended, of peace, privacy, domesticity, revelry, and charity, a sacred period in much broader sense than that associated with any one religion. Despite Christianity's apparent supremacy, however, many of the old customs survived. Not at least feasting during the festive cycle could become an end to itself, so much so that church elders worried that the veneration of Christ was being lost. St. Gregory of Nazarene, who died in 389, urged his flock, quote, the celebration of Christ's birth after a heavenly and not after an earthly manner, end quote, complaining that there were, quote, feasting to excess, dancing and crowning the doors, that means decorating the doorways, end quote. More than a century later, both Augustine de Hippo and Pope Leo the Great again felt compelled to remind their people that Christ, not the Son, was their proper object of worship. St. Patrick, in his Confessio, declared outright that any sun worshippers should be damned eternally. It should also be remembered that while the Roman Christianity was dominant culture in the far greater part of Western Europe, it was by no means the only one. In the 11th century, the Danes conquered most of England. So you should remember that. That's what Harold was going up. He was going up to fight the Danes. Bringing with them the Yule, Yule Fest, the colloquial term for a winter solstice celebration, probably derived from an earlier term for wheel. For centuries, the most sacred Norse symbol had been the wheel of the year, represented by a wheel or a cross within a wheel, the arms of the cross signifying solar rays. The Norse peoples, many of whom settled in what is now Yorkshire, would construct massive solar wheels and place them on top of hills, while in medieval times processions bore wheels and chariots or boats, and in some parts of Europe, a taboo on using spinning wheels during solstices lasted well into the 20th century. The spinning wheel on which Sleeping Beauty pricks her finger may exemplify this superstition, while the seven dwarves in Snow White may represent and then reckoned seven planets. A medieval law had it, seven greatest attendants of Earth. Well, yeah, I think he's probably overreaching here. An early 19th century miscellany elaborates on another connection between the wheel and solstice. According to, so this is just, he's got these notes and he's going to randomly shove them in his book somewhere. According to the authors, in much of Western Europe, the wheel was an integral part of summer solstice celebrations. In some places, they roll the wheel about to signify the sun. When occupying the highest place in the zodiac, it is beginning to descend. We read that this wheel is taken up to the top of the mountain and rolled down from thence, and that it had previously been covered by straw, twisted about it, and set on fire. It appeared to dance as if the sun had been falling, and the people imagine that all the ill luck unrolls away with them. We don't know the strength of this author. This is the whole problem. This is his historiography. It's readable, but you get no sense of the the methodology used in working out that. Dancers celebrating midsummer. Oh, you've got midsummer murders. Look at that. Isn't that cute? He should have included spinning wheels around that could go for a whole month. Blazing wheels were often accompanied by festive fires, lit in sacred reenactment of the creation of the universe, a tradition both summer and winter solstice. From at least the 13th century, the lighting of fires on Midsummer's Day became common across the whole of Europe, northwest Africa, Japan, and even Brazil. By the mid-19th century, Cornish immigrants in South Australia were celebrating their traditional European midsummer with a bonfire on the 24th of June, midwinter in the southern hemisphere. But until about the same date, in villages north of England, whole communities would meet together at the summer solstice, quote, and be merry over a large fire, which is made of that purpose in the open street. This, of whatever material, was called a bonfire, because such fires generally consisted of bones. There is a nice homily of the known of unknown date by De Fosto Sancti Jonas Baptiste. So he's just saying it's a nice homily. Now, just reading the footnote for the whole month. This is interesting. So this is for the whole month. The feast of Saint Vitalis, the cult of whom took over from the sun gods in some countries, falls on the 15th of June, close to Midsummer's Day. In 1370, an epidemic of cholera broke out in Germany, especially along the Rhine Valley, its victims fall into involuntary convulsions. Their sad antics so resembled the annual celebrations that the disorder became known as St. Vitus Dance. So this is a quote from this chap, Joan Baptist. The worship of St. Joan, in the worship of St. Joan, people waked at home and made three manners of fires. One of clean bones and no wood, and that is called a bone fire. Another of clean wood and no bones, and that is called a wood fire, or people for people to sit and wake thereby. The third is made of wood and bones, and this is called St. Joan's fire. Well, so bonfire is a bone fire. That's pretty amazing. And you can imagine this would be a very bright flame, very intense bright flame with not so much heat, because you've got the calcium ions emitting it, whereas the other ones you have the carbon burning, and depending on the heat, your normal fire doesn't get bright until it's really hot. There's a lot of heat given out because it's black body radiation, whereas like a bone fire is like a fluorescent light. So a fluorescent light is iron radiation of mercury, but this is like a calcium lamp. You've got a sodium lamp. So this is equivalent to a sodium lamp back then. So Midsummer's Day was a magical time, far more than winter solstice, an occasion for a myriad of superstitious doing. Shakespeare, inspired by merrymaking and tomfoolery of the season, set A Midsummer's Night Dream at the solstice. Norwegian court records tell us of how witches, fortified at home with homebrew ale, would fly through the air on Midsummer's Eve, often on the backs of cats. While in Russia, Belarus, and Ukraine, it was believed that naked she-devils climbing up through the chimneys would launch themselves into the air. Francis Gross, a late 8th century original who began as a British officer of dragoons deployed to catch smugglers before switching to a career as an artist and an antiquary, wrote. So he's looking, he's strange. You can imagine smugglers, people would be, he'd be inspecting things and getting a taste for art. Any unmarried woman fasting on Midsummer's Eve at midnight, laying a clean cloth with bread, cheese and ale, and sitting down as if going to eat, the street door being left open, the person whom she is afterwards to marry will come to the room and drink to her by bowing, and after filling the glass will leave it on the table and, making another bow, retire. He adds that anyone who fasted on Solstice Eve and sat in a church porch at midnight would see the spirits of the parishioners fated to die that year knocking at the church door. Well, there you go. In some countries, the celebratory fires of Midsummer's Eve were so also meant to ward off evil spirits, and so were crowned with straw dolls, or witches' brooms and hats, while encroaching darkness at the time of winter solstice never failed to arouse fears that the sun would burn out completely. Hence the kindling of the Yule log and the Hanukkah lights. And it's interesting, Hanukkah, it's light. And later tied both to lunar and solar calendars. The boar's head at Christmas feast represents the sundial with the old year, and the suckling pig with the apple of immortality in the mouth anew. So that's what a suckling pig with an apple in it. A suckling pig means a small, breastfeeding pig. And so it's interesting because we've got two eating pork, and we have pork, us eating hams at Christmas as well. Outside Europe, customs varied wildly. In Japan, young men known as sun devils, their faces daubed to represent their imagined solar ancestries, would go from farm to farm to ensure the earth's fertility. So Japan's a really interesting solar culture. In China, the winter solstice on the masculine yang energies, and the summer solstice the yin. So it's after the summer solstice the days are going to get colder. In early times, a sacrifice, often human, was offered to the sun, the smoke joining heaven and earth. The Aztecs, who believed that the heart held fragments of the sun's heat, ensured its continual well-being by tearing out the vital organ from hunchbacks, dwarfs, and prisoners of war, so releasing the divine sudden fragments entrapped by their body and its desires. So isn't that amazing that you're alive with some a sun life energy and ripping out hearts is a solar renewal. I've just got this big mosquito coming to feast off me. It's quite interesting, though. They love blood thinners, mosquitoes. Even sporting events were aligned with the role. In 2005, I visited the sport field in Chichen Itza in central Yucatan, which I think is in Mexico, and was shown a 15th century carving that depicted the bloody aftermath of one game the Mayans had played there. Well, so the authority of this is actually pretty thin, okay, because he's been shown a picture and he's got no academic story before him. In the contest intended to guarantee the sun's rebirth at the time of the vernal equinox, so that's equal night and day, two teams, why you want a rebirth, the equinox doesn't make sense. Two teams, each of seven players, and personifying light and darkness, played a la Malizithildi. I'll spell it to you. U-double-L-A-M-A-L-I-Z-T-L-I. So that's where I run out of pronunciations. The T-L-I-Z-T-L-I. I don't know how to pronounce that one. In which a soldier of a ball represented the sun's path on its nightly passage beneath the world. The players using upper arms and hips, I do remember this, had to prevent it from hitting the ground or going out of bounds. Alas, for the captain of the winning team, however, because he became the sacrifice whose blood revitalized the sun and earth at the culminating ceremony, literally losing his head as a matter of honour. Well, there you go. So in modern Mexico, they're showing the burning sun ball. Above all other rituals, reproducing the sun by creating fires on earth is the commonest solstice practice at both midsummer and midwinter. In Iran, families still observe the originality of Zoroastrian winter solstice festival at Zelda, with night-long vigils, fires blazing against the darkness, and similar celebrations take place in Tibet and Muslim northwest India. Northwest, that's might be called Pakistan. Thomas Hardy, by describing Dorset villages around a bonfire in the Return of the Native, offers an explanation for such a worldwide phenomenon. Okay, well there you go. This is it's beautiful literature, but it's not good academic stuff. It seemed as if bonfire makers were standing in some radiant upper story of the world, as if these men and boys had suddenly dived into the past ages and fetched therefrom an hour and a deed which had before been familiar with this spot. Indeed, it's pretty well known that all such blazes as in the heathen were now enjoying a rather than lineal descendants of the jumbled druidical rites and Saxon ceremonies, with the invention of the popular feeling about the gunpowder plot. Okay, there's an explanation of the gunpowder plot. This would be Guy Fawkes and all that type of stuff, which I think he would therefore claim is that they had this ceremony going and they co-opted it. Okay, well, let's see what he says. There's a big footnote. Moreover, the light, the fire, is instinctive and resistant act of men when, at winter ingress, a curfew sounded throughout nature. Isn't that beautiful? So it's getting very winter, all the animals are going to sleep. It indicates a spontaneous Promethean rebelliousness against the fate that this recurrent seasonal shall bring foul towns, cold, darkness, misery and death. But chaos sometimes, and the fettered gods of earth say, let there be light. Which is also interesting that winter solstice is sort of coming together to get you through the darkness of winter. So you can imagine that you also, if you are in a small community, you want to feast, make sure that everyone eats the food. There's another thing, is that if you have all people eating the food, people can fill up and get fortified against winter. So rather than actually going into winter, so the worst of winter in Europe is going to come, because after the winter solstice comes the depths of winter. So there's a bit of a lag there. So having the feast early and spread across the community, you get to check on everyone. It's a good sort of check the cabin doors. Okay, so I'm going to read this thing about Guy Fawkes, the gunpowder plots. So you'd know that Guy Fawkes night is this thing. On the 5th of November, at 1605, Guy Fawkes and his fellow conspirators were detected attempting to blow up King's Lords and Commons, an event that became known as the Gunpowder Plot. In the Parliament that so narrowly escaped destruction was postponed until the beginning of the following year, when an MP proposed perpetual annual thanksgivings whose service remained in the Anglican prayer book until 1859. By 1620s, it had become the most popular state commemoration in the calendar, surpassing by far even the King's and Queen's birthdays. In the last decades of the 18th century, by 10 o'clock, London was so lit up by bonfires and fireworks that the suburbs look as that's one's red with heat. Okay, well, by the 18th century, that's okay, after the fire of London. No longer witches, brooms, but effigies of Fawkes, and sometimes the Pope, often stuffed with live cats which would shriek as the flames engulfed them, were paraded atop each fire. Well, yeah, and that's what I was told. I was told that this legend of live cats, I was told that piñatas used to have kittens in it. Yeah, I don't know why you get these things. It's interesting that the pagan festivals gets co-opted from time to time. While solstice celebrations have always been the most common, other feasts mark the changing of the seasons have taken place throughout the year. French historian Emmanuel de Roy Ludre wrote an entire book about one carnival that took the town of Romans in 1580, and the records the appearance of what has become known as the Candlemas Bear. This will be the Groundhog Day. Every 2nd of February, the beast would be prodded from the den and peer into the sky. Were it cloudy, superstition held, the bear would be unable to see its shadow, and so it would behave as if winter were on the way. But if it saw a shadow, because the weather was bright, it would be frightened back into its hole, and winter would endure for another 6 weeks. So that seems counter-logical. The bear even now is employed in such festivals in the Alps and the Pyrenees, while elsewhere, other hibernating animals perform a similar role. Ireland as a hedgehog for St. Bridget's Day, the 1st of February, while Pennsylvania and other parts of North America celebrate Groundhog Day every 2nd of February, a folk custom introduced by French and German settlers. So, this February, we're expecting the end of winter. Okay. The Roman festivals, which, with so many others in France, came under attack during the Revolution of 1789. Leaders of that great convulsion were determined to abolish traditional Christian holidays. Sundays were to be work days. A new calendar would be produced in order through a new order promulgated. How to begin the year was easy to settle. Since the Republic had been declared on the autumn equinox of 1792, on that day, a revolutionary firebrand declared to be to the Convention of Paris, the flame of liberty illuminated the French nation. A new day, the first of Vendée-Marie, which is the first day of the month of Gales, was explicitly a celestial meeting, as is clear from the countrywide events that were planned to commemorate it. The municipal administration of Aurac in the Cantal, one of the 83 departments created by the Revolution, in the south-central France, described how this glorious pageant should be celebrated. Then will appear, this is how the description, then will appear a superb, shining chariot drawn by 12 horses. This will be the chariot of the sun. Before it will begin, will be the signs of the zodiac, and hours according to their new division. Besides, it will work young citizeness. I think it's a citizeness. Henri is an interesting one. Dressed in white, who will represent the hours of the day, while young citizeness, dressed in white and veiled in black, will represent the hours of the night. On the chariot will be seen the still slumbering genius of France, covered with a veil, decorated with fleur-de-lis, and from the time to time making simple movements. It will be really interesting, weird, and boring. For about a decade, such festivals were enthusiastically celebrated throughout France. But such zeals could not last, why not? And soon the old festivals and calendars returned. The revolutionary system became part of history, with life bursting spring month of Germinal. Okay, so this is, they've got different ones memorized in the title of Zolli's 1885 novel, The Thermidor. And Thermidor, a lobster dish. So there's these months, which, let's go, Ventimiglia. What are they? Germinal and Thermidor. I don't know what Thermidor is, but it's a month. They're funny, the sort of months, aren't they? Because they're half months. The sun celebrations cut across time and culture, but possibly the most dramatic are the sun dances of the North American Indians. They're usually held in late June or early July before the buffalo hunt, or to recruit the power of the sun cycle over the crops. You've got Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kids, he should mention. Most sun dances centered on a lodge, usually a circle of 28 forked poles that represented the 28 days of the lunar month. This is hard to believe. These would be joined together by more poles laid horizontally in the fork uprights. Witness likened one to a circus tent on top of which they had been ruthlessly torn away by a cyclone. So it's just the walls of a circus tent. Entrances to the lodge face the sunrise. Sometimes a host of lodges, as many as 700 enclosing over 10,000 celebrants, will be arranged in one huge circle as much as 6 miles in circumference. Yeah, I think that's sort of 6 miles in circumference. So that's 2 pi r. That's 6, so that's 1 kilometer radius. Now that's just getting on the bordering of the ridiculous. So 700, or 6, is that miles? What's it say? 6 miles, so that's getting on 1.5 kilometers radius, and that's 10 kilometers, that's 70 meters between tents. It's very hard to believe that number. For all these clans, the rites often took place under a full moon. What events, ever it others benefits, the sun dance has an occasion for the energetic couplings. Okay. Each tribe had its own characteristics. The Shoshone and the Crow called the ceremony the First Lodge. The Cheyenne, the Medicine, in the sense of making magic lodge. The Lakota Sioux was the We Yan Yang Wachipi, the dance starting at the sun. In Arizona, the Papago hopped around the solar symbol in alternating direction, extending their hands forward to the sun, then stroking their chest to take in its power. I can imagine that last one is the most, the last paragraph is the more believable. The spectacle reached its fullest development among the Tenton Sioux. The participants congregated in a sweat lodge, a kind of sauna that served as the preliminary purification. So it has to have a roof. There's going to be a sweat lodge. The medicine men would pray for fair weather, and the dance leader would bring together an ornamented pipe. A perfectly formed buffalo skull and some buffalo fat would then follow the setting up of a sun pole representing the path to the sky, a tobacco offering, and a dance of supplication. These preparations would take up to 3 to 4 days, during which initiates would fast. Their mounting hungers sometimes bring spectacular visions. Oh dear. In some more intricate versions, participants would raise tents in a circle representing the Aurora Borealis around the bush dance enclosure. Some 15 feet went the central pole, symbolising the sun. Okay, I just have some doubts about all of this. Okay. Just one of these things is, like, Cook takes a hell, this is James Cook in Australia, takes a hell of a lot to read and decode, and when you've got all these authors, this is really hard to decode. Look, there's a picture here of these Indians in a sun dance. We don't know where it's from. In The Origin of Table Manners, I don't know where this comes from, Claude Levi Strauss explores, says that the genes person explores the ambiguous and equivocal nature of these dances. Equivocated, it means Jesuits, you know, is this good or bad? You get confused by listening to him. On the one hand, the Indians prayed to the sun to be favorably disposed towards them. On the other hand, they provoked and defied it. One of the final rites consisted of a frenzied dance, which was prolonged until after dark. In spite of the exhausted state of participants, the Aparo called it, quote, gambling against the sun. On the Gros venture, the dance against the sun. These are different tribes. The aim was to counteract the opposition of the intense heat of the sun, who had tried to prevent the ceremony taking place by radiating its warm rays every day during the period preceding the dance. The Indians then looked up on the sun as a dual being, indispensable for human life, yet at the same time representing a threat to mankind. The only comment where I find this credible is that when you speak to very old people, a lot of old people have died, but they, centenarians and stuff like that, they're talking about life pre-World War One, around World War One. They would spend days in an activity. So we can't imagine dancing for a day because we'd stop. We can only do things for a few hours at the moment. But these older people could do things for hours. They would have a dance would last 6 hours. You know how we just go out to a pub about, we'd be lucky if we'd stay there an hour before it's time to knock on and move on. Because we don't have cars and we don't have, because we have cars and because we have multimedia, we've got a different sense of time. Okay, quote, the dance itself began at sunrise, continued for as long as 5 days. On the first morning, pledgers happily, perhaps 50 strong, painted their bodies red for sunset, blue for sky, yellow for forked lightning, and black for night, often including a form of a sunflower. Each wore an apron of deer or antelope skin, rabbit fur, wristlets and anklets, and a downy feather in his hair, carrying in his mouth an eagle wing bone whistle with a porcupine quill or beadwork or an eagle down decoration. That's could be possible because eagle bones are hollow because they're birds, so you can make a whistle out of it. But just if you look at the sheer magnitude, like, you can decorate one person, but a primitive society getting all this eagle stuff together, it's just hard to imagine. Of course, the other thing is that they've got no storages, you know, they can't store their gear. It's one of the things in primitive cultures, it's got no boxes of storage. They don't have a shed to put things in. So it's just interesting to read this. The pledges circled the phallic pole and saluted the sun to drumbeats and intense singing. With their faces fixed on the great solar orb, they danced on their toes and balls of their feet. Quote, to participate in the cosmic renewal of life by shedding their blood for the sake of all life, they would lash their arms and thighs as many as 200 times and suspend themselves from 8-inch wooden skewers inserted by the Kuya Kiapi holy man into the small of their backs or their shoulders. The skewers were attached to the central pole by a tightly wound rawhide thongs at the height of such that only the participants' toes touch the ground. Alternately, some participants would suspend themselves upside down, their bodies hanging like corpses. The excruciating ordeal that Richard Harris undergoes in the 1970s Hollywood version of the ceremony in A Man Called Horse. So, look, I'll have to get that on YouTube. A test of any dancer's honour was not to scream or cry out. Yeah, it's you've got to sort of understand these things. So they could go for hours. That's trying to work this out. Urged on by the rest of the tribe, each brave would pull hard on his wounds until he fell unconscious or tore himself loose, releasing him from the vow and signifying his willingness to suffer. Once freed, the liberated dancer would, after a prescribed interval, smoke pipes, spit the clouds, enjoy the vapor bath, and at last drink and take in food, customarily dog soup and buffalo meat, in a continuing feast. So, given that the buffaloes got killed out pretty quickly, one wonders how they know too much about this. At least 10 Plains tribes adopted the main elements of this ritual. Others performed the ceremony without spilling blood. To the outside, such self-mutilation seemed monstrous. Jesuits claimed to convert the heathen Indians were peculiarly virulent in their condemnation. But the historian Joseph Epps Brown, who would collaborate with the Lakota chief Black Elk in his Apologia, The Sacred Pipe, 1948, compares the sun dance with the Hindu meditation techniques and the sun dance pole with the crucifix, equating the sufferings of the dancers with the extreme forms of Christian penance. Well, that sort of does make sense. We have this one of Christ. When the man, in awful ceremony, is actually tied to the tree at the centre by the flesh of his body, Brown tells us, quote, or when women make offerings of pieces cut from their arms, sacrifice through suffering is accomplished that the world and all beings may live, the life be renewed, that man may become who he is. The sun dance, thus, is not a celebration by man for man. It's an honouring of all life and the source of all life, that life may go on. The circle may be a cycle. Now, which is interesting about that. So you've got Jung saying that people have to do it because they're making nature operate. It's sort of like this second thing. I wish I could actually name that. That's when you have an explanation and then the explanation starts to take over you, which is a really interesting thing. That's a human thing that I'm doing this for everyone's good, and then eventually you start behaving, you get sucked into your explanation. In his moving account, the Kiwa on One River, the ethnologist Wade Davis writes, the sun dance was by far the most significant religious event of their lives. It was a celebration of war, a time of spiritual renewal, a moment at which the entire tribe partook in the divinity of the sun. But its very existence was threatened by white man. On the night of the 13th of November, 1838, a great meteor shower blazed across the prairie sky, alarming the whole tribe and prompting the elders to predict the end of the world. A forecast turned out to be accurate for the world of the Kiwa. Their first contact with white soldiers came the following summer. By 1890, East Coast administrators banned the sun dancers altogether. Okay, I'm just having a mosquito scratch there. So Davis, who's here, this is a footnote. Davis, who rejoices in the title Explorer in Residence at the National Geographic, or GM, makes the point that modern celebrants no longer allowed the excesses of old chew on peyote as a substitute means of achieving enlightenment. So peyote must be a drug or something. A tribesman told Davis that peyote was like buffalo of ancient times, both the children of the sun. Peyote is the incarnation of the sun, as are the buffalo. So this is an interesting side quote. At the other end of history, of the Lakota suits, Clyde Holler asks simply, why on earth are they still dancing the sun dance? And amongst the reasons he offers are this. To attend the Sundance is to feel the power to approach religious ecstasy, to experience for oneself the essence of religion based on power. Wow. The Sundance sweeps away possible doubts about the existence of sacred power in a searing emotional catharsis. Okay, so it's just so shocking that you can't really think. And this is interesting. I think there are people... You've got to actually look at people who are phrased in ceremonial management. So that they come in and their plans are ceremonial plans and their operations are ceremonies. It's pretty amazing to think about it. I know what I'm thinking. He might have mentioned physical catharsis too. Dance promotes uninhibited, the irrational, indeed, even sexual release, orgastic excess. In The Birth of Tragedy, Nietzsche set the Dionysian nature of the dance against the Apollyon opposites. Balance, reason, and discipline. Bureaucrats in Washington went alone. The Protestants of Tudor and Jacobean England, the Inquisitor of the Midi, the Conquistadors who savagely mastered South America, the Goetheers, Gaolites, and National Socialism, all of them tried to regulate and contain solo-related dance rites, if not actually outlaw them. Oh, yeah. This is sort of the joy of reading someone rant, isn't it? In those countries where ceremonial dances came under sponsorship of the state, attempts were made to fix them to a particular time and place rather than allowing them to arise spontaneously at some untried location. This is a bit confused. This made sun celebrations easy to manage while still giving them the celebrants an outlet. And in truth, worshippers, including those honoured the sun, yearned for central sites where they could congregate and pay homage. Further, in prehistoric societies, the embodiment of their gods in stone was symbolic of the change in religion that has taken place. From nature worship to that of heavenly bodies, material structures, Stonehenge, known throughout the Middle Ages as the Giant's Dance. Oh yes, the pyramids and those great erections in South America, all sites came to embody beliefs, not at least about the sun. Okay, so this is the last chapter two, and he's talked about his first chapter was directly beliefs about the sun and the sun coming down and interfering with human life and the ruling elite being associated with the sun and a mythology of the sun. These ones are just celebrations of the season. There's a bit of an overlap here, and you've got, obviously, the Indians doing a big sun dance. And it's interesting that the sun is a sort of, if you don't have a central architecture, lots of like roads and buildings, the sun comes across here. I'm just reading back through it. You've got the other things, like just people spontaneously burning fires, and they're it's hard to say. It's like there's a continuum of beliefs between the first chapter, which is the myths, and the sun is a backdrop, is a setting for the myth. But the sun, it's hard to say. It's like, for me, I can't actually see this separation. So the people believe that the shards of the sun were in people's hearts, so they had to remove the hearts to release the sun's energy. This is a revelation for me to work through. So this overall is quite confusing, the sun dances to go across. There's, of course, you've got the issue that some of these descriptions are very large. If you read, or as I've read, historians refer to contemporary historians of Charlemagne, his descriptions of the size of armies and the size of things are made too big. And they're big enough to wow people sitting around the fire. People go, wow, that's big. Imagine this, imagine that. So I think a lot of that has actually slipped into this. and you almost need I mean, it will make for boring writing, and this is against skill, but you need a organization chart or Venn diagram to actually identify, or basically a sort of coordinate system to plot in multiple dimensional space. So he's quite a good author, but I do have reservations. We're only up to page 39, so we're less than 10% of the way through this book. Thanks for listening, and there are these gaps in the book, and it's interesting how the French Revolution, when they didn't have religion, they went back to the sun celestial stories. That they still need the underlying metaphor here. There are these really interesting gaps here. I've read about very interesting solar religions which have not been raised so far. So I'm going to read ahead and see if I can piece them out. There's also a sort of lack of understanding of the physics for the variation equinox and things like that. So I'll see if I can actually set out and explain it a little bit better. Thanks for listening. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.